Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
All right, angry music is appropriate for angry people. The angriest, Jeff Kenny, normally is last. He will be first today. Jeff, I'm going to introduce people in order of anger. Jeff Kenny joins us first. Jeff, how are you?
Good. Thanks, Mac. I'm good. I actually, not only angry, I got a little bit of indigestion, so I'm being rare form.
Angry plus indigestion. That's always good. Number two on the angry list is Will Costantini. Will, how are you?
I'm angry that I'm not number one.
You should be, right? It just comes from a lack of commitment to being angry, so I think you got some work to do. And last but not least is Tim Lynch, who's always happy, from McAllen, Texas, or living in McAllen, Texas. Timmy, how are you? You're the least angry man here. Well, other than me, I'm less angry than you. But how's it feel to be the happy guy in the group?
It feels spectacular. I just got a little bit of a dopamine hit just hearing you say those words. And so I'm doing great.
All right. My dad passed away, as you guys all know. And so I don't know why, you know, I get this ominous text message that I fear every week. Topics from Will, question mark. And so I was looking for things to talk about. But I thought, you know, we have all in our lives dealt with death. And I wondered if you guys had any advice for, you know, it happens in life. People, you know, have to do it. So, Jeff, we'll start with you. Do you have any way that you do death? Do you have any things you've learned about doing it? You've done a fair amount in your life, both in the Marine Corps and also, you know, with family members and things like that. Any advice you give people?
Oh, geez. I mean, I guess, you know, it depends. Like, I got a couple categories. Like, family, you know, like my father passed away in 2013. And even though he was like getting on to be close to being 86, he was fine. And all of a sudden, within 2 months, he got throat cancer and esophageal cancer, and you know, he died pretty quick. And it was upsetting because of that. And so basically, what happened was he's Irish, my dad, and so the remaining family members, we had a memorial service / funeral for him, because he was in Connecticut about a week and a half, 2 weeks after he died. And it was, I don't want to say this, but my cousins and my brothers and I, we really, and my son, Nick, came up there with me. The other two were too far away. But it was actually a good time, you know, remembering the good stuff about my dad. And, you know, it's never, I guess that's a way of dealing with it, you know. Then there was young dudes who I know who got killed in combat, and that's a harder one, because sometimes the guy would get killed and I'd be there. Sometimes I hear about him getting killed, and it was hard for me to go to funerals and stuff. I don't know why. The most compelling one was CO of one of the rifle companies in 1-5 in 2005, I think it was, in Ramadi. He's actually a second cousin of mine, John Maloney. And he was a great guy. He got killed. Two company commanders. Eric Smith was a battalion commander, and he lost. I don't know if you were there out there at that time, Mac. But,
no, I had come home. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he lost two company commanders. One of them was John. And John worked for me at IOC as a captain. And so I brought him up there. He was a sharp kid, and he was a weapons platoon commander for EI Company, which is what I was when I got to IOC. And so I'm talking to him, you know, and we're talking, where are you from? Well, he's from Springfield, Massachusetts. Where are you from? I'm from Hartford. And, you know, we're talking a little bit about relatives. And then I said, you know, my aunt is from Springfield. I can't remember how we got talking about it, but it turned out that his great aunt, June, was married to my Uncle Chet.
What?
And he remembered my Uncle Chet, because my Uncle Chet was he's a guy who could tell great stories and stuff. And like, if you look at pictures of my first wedding, you know, the big crowd of girls waiting to catch the bouquet. He's standing right there in the middle of him with a martini glass, you know. And he had white hair. He's a typical older Irish guy, you know. And so it turns out John Maloney and I were distantly related, you know. And he worked for me at IOC. He was just the best guy, you know. Everybody always said that. And when he got killed, I had a hard time, you know, hooking up with his family and everything because, I don't know. I'm not really giving advice at this point other than saying, you know, when you lose guys that you know that good, I mean, we all know this, you know, especially when it's a young guy who's got little kids and stuff like that. You know, it's just something you find yourself thinking about it when you're alone or on the weekends, and it comes over like, you know, that you start remembering all these guys you actually either were with or you knew them very well. And it's just, you know, it's something that, you know, I think you should talk about with people who went through that with you. But it's just something I've never really learned how to handle well, to tell you the truth.
Timmy, how about you?
Yeah, I'm like Jeff. I didn't tend to handle it well because death is so divorced from life in the way our country is today and given this time and place. And I got a different attitude on it when I was in Afghanistan. And the first thing I thought of when I saw what you wanted to talk about tonight was I was up in the north escorting some Japanese agricultural experts, and they pulled into a village. I think it was called Uzbek. It was a nice village, but the expert Tani-san had his women together. She had bought him a barn, and half the barn, the men were drying reefer in it, and she was exploding. So it got to be embarrassing, and I was asked to go wait in this room for the village headmen to come entertain me, and they put me in this garage, and there's a 13, 14-year-old girl laid out on a table in there, obviously dead. And nobody said a word about it. And I learned later that she was going to be prepared for burial and put in the ground that evening. But it was strange how there was no emotion tied to this entire thing. And from talking to friends I made in Afghanistan, I think the way to look at it is time. And how, what does time mean? Time being infinite and us being here for so short a time. I'm convinced, as are many people, particularly those that are religious, that spirit inside of us, our consciousness, our soul, that it's not going to go away. What happens to it, I don't know. But that gives me some comfort in dealing with death, because even at the end of life, my father's 86, going on 87. When we lose him, it's going to be a traumatic event for me, just like it was when I lost my mother. But I seem to be able to cope with it better when I think about it along the lines of, we've got an infinite amount of time in this world, and the chances that our consciousness disappears with our body is pretty remote. So I've always felt like there will be another time and place where once again we can interact. At least I like to think of it that way, and it helps me become a more stoic person when dealing with this, because that's generally what needs to be done when you're this oldest sibling or the guy in charge or whatever. Somebody's got to be there to kind of be the heavy shoulder that people are going to lean on, and I prefer it to be me, being the oldest in my family.
So, if you didn't have that belief in some type of afterlife, do you think you would be a howling banshee at these things?
Yeah, I think it would be very upsetting because there's always regrets. There's nobody's had a perfect relationship with anybody else. And there's always regrets when you lose somebody that's close to you, even people that aren't that close to you that you've interacted with. And the only way to let those regrets go and to be healthy about it is to maintain some type of perspective that allows you to let these things go and not be the end of the world. Because these things will send you for a loop. I would have told you after my mother passed when I was on recruiting duty that I was fine within a week, but I obviously was not. But that it's a strange thing for us because death is so divorced from the living, whereas 100, 200 years ago that was not the case.
Well. I mean, Will has, I mean, among all of us, is unique. He lost his spouse, but he's also, as a commanding officer, you know, he's, you know, lost Marines. What say ye, Will?
Yeah, I mean, Jeff said something, you know, there's categories. And you and I think a year or two ago, we talked about losing Marines. And there's been a lot of COs that lost Marines, and I may be unique in that when I deployed, we lost some men there. And, you know, how you deal with that as a CO, I recommend people go to the archives because we talked about that at length. And what makes me unique is when I went home, I had a company deployed, and that company lost some Marines, and I actually, as a battalion commander, handed the flag to those Marines next to kin. And that was really hard because many of those parents in particular were right about my age, just a little bit older. And my son at that point was in boot camp. And it was tough. Imagining yourself in their shoes, and then when General Kelly's son was killed, I was over there at the house. General Dunford notified him that morning. I was over at the house, and I told him, you know, sir, you're living my nightmare right now, and I think that would have been really something. In regards to family, you know, me and my wife talked about this quite a few times, that we considered ourselves really lucky. When my kids were born, they had 6 of their 8 original great grandparents still alive. And they really got to know 5 of them. So very long lived families on both sides of our families. And so when my wife passed away, you know, she was not particularly healthy, but she really wasn't sick. She really got sick on a Thursday. She had surgery on a Monday, didn't wake up from that, and she passed away on a Saturday. So I had about 9 days, and I really had about 3 days when I knew she wasn't coming out of this. And I really thought a lot in those 3 days, because I'd seen, particularly with young Marines, not Marines in first LAR, but when I was up in the ACMAC's office and going up to Bethesda to some very severely wounded guys, I'd seen some families really break apart, parents, accusing each other or encouraging their son to become a Marine, and now he's multiple amputee, et cetera. And I had a couple days to really, really think hard about it. And I said to myself, I'm not going to blame anybody for anything. I'm not going to be angry at anybody. And I'm not going to feel guilty. And that's a nice resolution to take. You can't help but feel guilt when someone really close to you, passes away. And then I think it's different with parents and kids, but with your spouse, it's really at our point in life where we're in our mid-50s and older. You know, one of your purposes in life is to take care of your wife, or your wife take care of your husband. And so I realized within weeks or months after that I realized that was my purpose, and that I didn't necessarily have a purpose. And that's probably been a
purpose in life anymore.
Yeah.
Right.
That was hard to figure out. Hey, what was I doing last year? Well, you know, I was sort of taking care of my wife. That's what I was doing. And we were just sort of cruising along. And all of a sudden it's gone. And in the year before, I couldn't have told you that that's what I was doing, but I figured out that's sort of what I was doing. And so that leads you to think about other things, as well. I mean, if I could give anyone any advice is that, you know, there's no time machine, right? You can't go back. Mm. You gotta live in those relationships in the moment. And you can't live that, hey, someone's going to disappear off the face of the earth in the next 10 seconds. But that being said, there is no time machine. You know, when I think about my wife in particular, had the situation been reversed, I think that the only thing I would have wanted is for her to be happy. And so, I would think that she would think the same thing. And I'm trying, to do that and trying to do it without blaming people, without being angry at people, without feeling guilty for things you didn't do or did do. But it's been, it was March 30th last year. It's been a year and a half, and it's every day for me. I think it's different based on the category of person. Although I'll tell you something else. Every Marine I lost, I say their name every day too. It ain't going away, you know, but I would tell people you can't destroy your own life. Because someone you really care about is gone. There's really no purpose in that at all. So, that's what I think I've figured out in the last year and a half in particular. And maybe I knew some of that stuff before. I don't know.
I have a saying that I said to my kids for years, and it's kind of crass, but I'll say it here, you know, and that is that, you know, life's not for pussies, you know, and you hear that and you're like, oh, you know, but I mean that, I meant that sincerely, that life is tough, you know, and, you know, when I've said it to my kids and we've sat down and talked, you know, and I told them, you're going to fight for every bit of happiness you get on this planet, and you're going to fight to keep it. And life's going to kick you, and it's not going to kick you like once and wait for you to get up and dust yourself off and get ready in order to be kicked the second time. You know, and are you tough enough when life kicks you repeatedly to get up? And so to me, I've learned that about death. And it's, I think Jeff made a great point at the start when he talked about, and Will, you and Timmy have both amplified on it, about the different classes of, you know, your parents, you know, that have, you know, my dad was 88. You know, I mean, that's the circle of life, you know. What's not the circle of life is bearing kids. You know, I remember being in Afghanistan the morning that Robert Kelly was killed, you know, and hearing the news. And remember meeting him when he was, you know, I don't even know if he's a teenager yet. He and his brother having lunch with their dad, you know, come around the corner at Camp Pendleton and at the old Oak Club. And see, you know, I think he was still Major Kelly at the time, and go over and say hi and see the boys and whatnot. And then, and knowing that, you know, that General Kelly, you know, couldn't know at that point, right? All the things that go through your head and just how crushing. But I'll never forget the, you know, something I heard General Kelly say at his funeral. When I read kind of the remarks, and I've seen him say it since then. And for, you know, those of us who've had their, you know, kids, you know, wear the uniform, I think it's important. And that is, you know, it doesn't really matter what I think. It matters what Robert thought, and it matters where he wanted to be. And he was where he wanted to be. And although this hurts more than I could, and I'll tell you, the other thing that I'll never forget that he said was this. He said, you know, I've written letters and I tell people that I have kids and, you know, and I understand how they feel. And he said, I want to apologize to everybody I ever wrote that to. He said, because I had no idea how they felt. And I'll never forget that. You know, Will, you mentioned flags. And, you know, I've given two flags in my life, both to the same woman who just texted me like 30 minutes ago. And both her sons from East Grand Forks, Minnesota. I was friends with the family. Both were killed after combat deployments here in the United States. And and it's so much easier to be forward, where you can go in the intervening period, you know, what is it normally, 10 days between the time we do memorial services, and you can go find who did it and you can kill them. You can kill, you know, you find them, you kill or capture everybody who had anything to do with it. And when you go to the memorial service, there's at least a bit of solace. But the biggest thing is you're not watching the grief of a wife, the mother, and the children, worst of all. And then when you have to participate in that, I mean, that's brutal. That's brutal. You know, I've also, you know, my nephews were murdered when they were 4 and 6 years old. You know, I've seen, you know, I've seen that just, you know, of all the things I've ever seen in my life, I mean, that was by far the worst. And so to me, you know, parents dying at an old age, I mean, as sad as it is and as tough as it is to hear those words, right? Words you only hear once in your life. You know, you know, it's complete, right? And they lived life on their terms and whatnot. So I don't, in terms of the way I deal with it, you know, I think all the death that we've done collectively, I've honestly learned to celebrate their lives. And I really try to focus on that. And I really try to emphasize that to my kids, how lucky you were to know them, how lucky you were to have them in your life, and reflect a little bit. And, you know, if you love them and if they're that important to you, then take something that was great about their life and make that a part of your life forever. And in that way, that person never leaves your life. They'll continually be a part of your life, and you honor them with a piece of your life. And so, I mean, I really learned that, you know, in Iraq and Afghanistan, all the times that we did death, was the grief is too hard. You know, it sucks, man. And so, you know, that's the whole concept of the Irish wake, right? We're going to have a party. And we're going to talk about the good times, and we're going to celebrate this life. And hopefully they were in heaven a half hour before the devil knows they're dead, which is the old Irish kind of bastardized blessing. But I don't know that there's another way to do it, because when you're left with just the grief, especially with younger people, it's just, I mean, it sucks. It sucks. So any further comments before we move on?
I would say one thing, Mac. You said, you know, life isn't for pussies. The thing that my expression was, life is a contact sport. It's a contact sport. And if you don't get bruises, then you're not playing it the right way, right? If it doesn't hurt, then you didn't care in the right way. And because it's a contact sport, when you get hurt, you still got to get back in the game. And, you know, it's not going to go away, but you still got to get back in the game. So I think that's what I've tried to do myself personally in the last year and a half or so.
Got it. Got it. Timmy, Jeff, any other comments about something that everybody does, and that's deal with death?
I would say that trying to deal with it by yourself is a fool's errand. This is where we are a social animal, us humans, and trying to ruck your way through one of these episodes, particularly with family members on your own, is not the way to go. That I can tell you for sure.
Wow. No, I mean, it's a, you know, this week I played all these interviews that I have with one of the wisest men that I've ever interviewed, and that's a guy who was a squad leader in India 3-9 in Vietnam, and his name is Jack Riley. He's been an inspirational guy for me, and I mean, those kind of lessons, I mean, everybody comes back from World War II, Korea, Vietnam, and what do? Well, they all shoulder their burden because they're men. And then they find out that, yeah, I can't do this. This is too much. And so, you know, the wisdom in what Tim says, and that is, don't fake it. Don't be afraid to talk about it. You know, both the good feelings that you have, the bad feelings you have. And again, the road that leads to really bad things begins with isolation. And so it's the stuff's tough, as Will said. Jeff, any final thoughts?
No, I agree with everybody. It's like not my favorite subject for sure, but absolutely, you gotta get with other folks about it.
Got it. All right, let's talk about Afghanistan. We kind of teased it last week, and about the Taliban have made some changes relative to their negotiating team. In the article that ran in the New York Times, entitled "Taliban Announced Brief Ceasefire as Afghan Peace Talks Look Imminent," now the approach to the peace talks has changed in no small way. This truce that has been put into action by them, and the changes to their negotiators. What do you make of all this, Timmy?
Well, this is an unfortunate situation because the Afghan side does not have a team identified yet. You've still got a lot of heartache between Abdullah and President Ashraf, and they're not on the same sheet of music. Conversely, the Taliban put Mullah Omar's son in charge, and he's legit as a Taliban fighter, specifically because he fought in the Helmand. That's a big bragging right for those guys that were in the Helmand and survived to talk about it.
Really?
But they've also got a bunch of guys that were captured early and spent a lot of time in Gitmo. And these particular Taliban leaders carry a certain amount of heft. We know that the Taliban cannot take over a city and hold it. They've tried for 20 years. They've never done this. And now we're facing a unified Taliban team that includes Omar's kid. It includes Haqqani's kid, and he's the biggest asshole of them all. And it includes some other rather heavy-hitting Taliban guys who spent years in Gitmo. So this is not good because there's no incentive for the Kabul government to cooperate. I don't think that Ashraf Ghani or the Minister of the Interior or the Minister of Defense want to enter into negotiations that cedes some or all of their powers away to their enemies. So we've negotiated, United States, we played the "we're going to go ahead and get out and let you two settle it." We played that as deftly as it can be played, which wasn't deft at all. And now we're confronted with a Kabul government who has no incentive at all to really negotiate in good faith with the Taliban, and a Taliban who has determined to start thinking about Afghan being a country where Afghans can live in peace. That's their words. That's not a bad – even if they're lying, that's not a bad way to go about announcing what you're articulating as a strategy. So I think what we're going to see is a debacle. With intercedence from the Kabul side, because again, there's no incentive for the Kabul government to start negotiating away their power and prestige. They're not going to do it. They're just not. And I think despite that, we're still going to leave. And this is going to be a tremendous shit show.
All right. Jeff, your thoughts?
Well, I mean, I think all that stuff that Tim said is probably true, you know, but, the Afghan government, this guy, Abdullah actually has he's actually got a pretty good point that he should be in charge. I mean, I think he won the election in 2009 against Karzai. And the other thing about Abdullah is he's not a Pashtun totally. You know, he's got Tajik blood too. And so why is that important? I think it's important because if he can square things away with Ghani, then they got the combat power to not only secure the population centers, I mean, Herat, Lash, Kargah, out there and down there in Kandahar and out in Jalalabad and up in Kabul and Mazar-e Sharif, they can do that. They got enough to secure lines of communication between them. And then there's really not much to Afghanistan. And they can win it because they certainly outnumber the bad guys. They got more combat power. They have artillery. They have air. They have ISR and things like that. there's no reason why they can't win. And if they don't win now, then they really don't deserve to win. And as far as the Taliban's, you know, strategy and everything, that hereditary stuff that Tim mentioned is a weakness of theirs. You know, I mean, there's nothing worse than nepotism for making sure that you got a mediocre, mediocre result. Just because the guy's dad was, you know, a ball of fire, sure as hell doesn't mean the kid's going to be. It doesn't mean he's not, but I mean, it's just not a good way of doing stuff. So I think, I have to tell you this though, the willpower is on the Taliban side. And for some reason, these guys, the haves in Afghanistan don't have the sand to hang in there. And Tim brought up this point like a year ago, I think, maybe even more, about we're going to stop paying their salary here pretty soon. And when we do, paying the salaries of the Afghan National Security Forces, then that's when they went belly up after the Soviet invasion petered out. The Soviets kept paying the salaries of the security force, you know, for a couple more years. And when that ran out, that's when, they overran, they took Najibullah and cut it, you know, castrated him and his brother, and the whole thing collapsed into what Timmy was describing. Total chaos and back to the dark ages.
Okay, Jeff, I want to ask you a question, because our official position for the long-term official Al-Marine Radio position has been that this was going to go back to the way it used to be, which would be big hitters, right, control the cities, right? And then the Taliban controls the rural area of Afghanistan. Is that where we're headed, in your opinion, still?
Yes. I think the best that the government can hope for is to be strong enough to control lines of communication, like the Ring Road, for instance, and maybe some other ones between those, you know, that connect the population centers. And I think that's about how it's going to go.
Got it.
That's really how it was in the old days too, you know, where they really didn't have control over the hinterlands, particularly in down by the Pakistan border in eastern Afghanistan and, you know, southern Afghanistan, Kandahar, all the way up to the Khyber Pass, all the way up to Nuristan. They just didn't really have, it was kind of tenuous.
Got it. All right. Will, your thoughts on these modifications to the Taliban group and also their truce? Is this the charm offensive before they really get after it?
I never served there. I only visited. And so when I listen to Jeff and Tim, they have a very tip of their fingers understanding of a lot more of the personalities in the locations. When I read about stuff like this, I try and bring it up to maybe a higher level. I don't think it's clear to either side that they've won or lost. The side that knows that they lost first is the loser. But I sense that if anybody thinks they might lose, it's the government side. We're leaving. I think the president's made that pretty clear. And so are they going to try and maintain control of the few areas that they can? And is the Taliban really interested in going all the way to complete victory to let those people know that they lost? I don't know if they have that will to do that or not. The Taliban will, I sense, be in control of their people. They'll have the drug trade. And what happens in downtown Kabul, I'm not sure how important that is to them. And it's because I'm genuinely really don't have any idea. I think that this could be a dysfunctional place, at least throughout the rest of our lifetimes. And to tell you the truth, what do we care?
Right.
If for some reason it becomes a a hotbed for terrorist training again. Well, maybe we've learned something in the last 19 years. Go in, punitive campaign, and leave. And if we never hear the word Afghanistan again, we'll all be better off for it.
So I want Will brought up something interesting. What is let's talk about perspective for a second. What's the Taliban perspective on this? Like, we own much of the country. Do we really want to own the cities? Do we really want to own the government? Is that what we really want? What Tim and Jeff, your perspective on that? What do the Taliban really want? Do they really want to own the whole country?
I think that they do. I think as a matter of prestige, of place and power, for assuming the head of a national government. And it's exactly why Ashraf Ghani is not going to bargain in good faith with the Taliban, because he doesn't want to diminish his prestige and power as the head of a country. I think the Taliban are willing to share power, but they're going to want some power. And once things start to fall apart, and keep in mind, from 2010 until now, you've had an almost doubling of the Afghans living underneath the poverty line. That's less than 700 Afghani, or about $1.50 a day. That was going down when we were there, because there were dollars everywhere, dollars leaking out all over the roads, for Christ's sakes, just about. But the population, who is now educated and exposed to the internet, is getting drastically poorer. And at some point, that house of cards is going to fall apart. And the question then is, who's got enough cohesion to take power? Because that's ultimately what's going to happen.
But do you think that – okay, so let's just – I will place your aids here for a second, and then, Jeff, I want you to hop in, and then we'll – you know, feel free to pile back on. If we do the dance of the negotiations and they fail, they're doing the kabuki dance. And so do we resume military we resume military operations? Does the Taliban, do they look inward and say, do we have the ass to go in those cities and fight? Timmy, Will, I mean, Jeff?
No, they don't have the ass to do it. They've been trying for 20 years. The closest they get is Kunduz, and they get ejected rather handedly. But they don't need to go in and control the cities. What they have is a unified, for the first time in my memory, they've got a unified front. And they've got people who have a serious set of objectives that they're willing to negotiate about, and they're being confronted with the other side, which is being intransigent. They're not willingly cooperating in their own destruction at all. So the talks are not going to go anywhere. They're going to peter out. This thing's going to keep on getting uglier and uglier, and we're just going to keep on ignoring it and slipping out the back door. But we got to make sure everybody gets paid. Right up until the point that we still got people in the country. Once we're left, we can go ahead and pull the funding. But I just don't see us staying. As Will said, the president's made it pretty clear he has no interest in staying, and there's not much we can do right now, because our side is a side that's not cooperating in this process.
Well, we've laid out this kind of road and this vision, which is, this thing that we've thrown out there, and, they'll go down it. And if they don't, like, we left, sorry, good luck. So, Jeff, your thoughts on perspective relative to the Taliban. Do they want to own all of Afghanistan? Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, and I'll tell you why. Because they're like the only Afghan branch, besides the new ISIS people that are there, that's really about Islam. And there's what I mean. In order for them to fight off the Russians in the 80s, they had to claim that the Russians were threatening Islam in Afghanistan. They needed money, especially from the outside, to help them fight off the Soviet. And so they became a lot more religiously inclined than most Afghans ever were, to include the Pashtun. Now, they were... This Pashtun Wali thing, the customs of the Pashtun that treats women like animals and stuff like that, is even worse than it is in other parts of the Middle East. But it's not as it really wasn't that type of behavior isn't really so much Islam as it is just their culture. And but these guys have latched on to their identity is Islam. And once the Russians left, you know, like Timmy was saying, when the Russians stopped paying them, they had – you had Hekmatyar's guys against fucking Massoud's guys against, you know, what's his name? The vice
Haqqani.
President. Yeah, Haqqani. But then there's also the guy who's always a government guy. He was in that movie.
12, Dostum.
Dostum, yeah, Dostum. All those guys, they destroyed Kabul fighting among the five of them themselves. You know, they turn that thing into a desert. The question is, will they do that? Will that happen again? And here's, I think, a reason why it might not happen again. Because like Tim said, they've been really modernized by us being there, you know, these last 20 years or so. They've really, like, the internet and people are a lot more educated, or at least what better informed about what the rest of the world is like. On the other hand, every fucking guy who had any kind of rank in Afghanistan that I knew had a place in a safe country that he siphoned all the money he could steal from his troops, all the money he could embezzle. Like the governor of Nangarhar, when Tim and I were there, was Sherzai. Remember that guy, Tim?
Oh, yeah.
And this guy took like 25 cents off the every dollar that came through the Khyber Pass and through Torquem Gate. And so, and all of them, you talk to me and say, "Yo, I have a house in Dubai." Wait a minute, you got a house? I don't have a house in Dubai. I don't even have a house in America. I can't even afford a house in fucking Alabama. How come you have that? And the reason, because when things get too rough, you know, when the shit gets, you know, I'll stick with you through thick and thin, but when the shit gets thick, they're thinning out, man. You know? And so that may, the Jeff Kenney pessimist part of me thinks, as soon as that pay stops, and as soon as things start getting a little sweaty, they're gone to India, they're gone to Dubai, they're gone to Zurich, they're gone to Cleveland. You know, all those people that basically been hoarding the money we've been pumping in there since 2001. And that's not even counting the dope money, which magnifies by tenfold.
Got it. So, oh, yeah. So we don't believe the Taliban has the ass to do it, but if they keep up the fight and they threaten these people, they'll leave, and it's possible that it could collapse?
Yeah, possibly.
Got it. All right, let's talk about the government perspective. You know, the government doesn't have the will or the capability. I mean, you know, just controlling the Ring Road would be an incredible feat if they could do that. Right. So the government perspective, first of all, they've got to fight the competition that they currently have within the government. Right. You know, Ghani and Abdullah, you know, going back and forth. So they've got to get through that. Right. To get to this negotiation. And what's the government perspective in this? Like, let's not give up too much. How do they form a government going forward with the Taliban?
That was what I was getting at earlier when I was talking about they have no real incentive to be talking with the Taliban, because the only thing that the Afghan government can do is give up parts of their power. You know, the president, the various line ministry heads, all these guys are going to have to give up a piece of their pie in order to make everything right. And there's nothing I've seen in the Afghan mind that indicates anybody's willing to do that, regardless of which side they're on. So the government has – the only incentive they have is to keep the donor money flowing. And even that is kind of precarious, because you don't know what's going to happen here in November. That spigot could be turned off come January 22nd, for all we know. And believe me, the people in Kabul pay attention to that kind of stuff. So the only incentive they have is to appear to cooperate enough that the donor money continues to flood in. And that's easy to do, because all they have to do is point at the women and the kids and play on the heartstrings of the kind Westerners who donate to make sure that the women have equal rights in a country where they're never going to have equal rights. I don't care who the hell's in charge. Right. That's ridiculous.
Right.
But
right.
That's the card they'll
that's
play.
The play. So that's the play. So the government play is to string this thing sideways, knowing that we'll need to get out if we have to, but that we are at our apex right now in militarily. And if we can't do it now, We're not, and the Americans unasked this thing. We're not in the greatest position yet. We don't have any interest in negotiating with the Taliban.
I have to tell you, it's like I always compare it to Vietnam in 1975. I mean, what we did was shameful. After all the promises we made to those guys, we just stopped supplying them with spare parts and we trained their army to be like ours, to be an army of machines. And so they had no hope. But this is different in Afghanistan. They got everything, and the other guys got UNGAT. They got like, they got 107 millimeter rockets. They got fucking, a shitload of IEDs, and they got crazy people, who do suicide bomb stuff, which they never did in Afghanistan, really, until this part of the war. You didn't see that shit with them in the 90s, when they were fighting each other or even against the Russians. Right. So, they've got that now. And so the other thing is dope. Like they could figure out a way to make us look the other way, as far as the dope goes. They could fucking hire Eric Prince to secure and his fucking band of commandos to secure the Ring Road, and then hired a couple other companies to help them beef up, the area near the embassy and, important parts of Kabul. And the same thing with JBAD and of course the Torkham Gay area and all these important things. And make a fight of it that way. But these guys are singularly unpatriotic bunch, in my opinion.
Well, no, but you know, I was just going to say that. I mean, but we're talking about businessmen, right? They're businessmen looking at a business proposition. Yay?
Yeah.
The way a mafia family does.
Got it.
And you still got, and half of these, to me, the core of the fucking Taliban is the Pashtun. They're really the strength of it. And they're not just in Afghanistan. Over half of them are down there in Waziristan and Pakistan, So it's like, I don't even think they even give a shit about Afghanistan. Most of them care about parts of Afghanistan more than anything else.
Well, I think though, if you look at it more as a business endeavor and less as a nation, I think the approach of looking at it as a business endeavor gets you further down the road to understanding it.
Yeah.
A mafia business endeavor where as long as we're fighting each other, the money's coming in, let's stay at it. Right. You mean like that? Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's right about that. Cause like there'll always be Doctors Without Borders. There'll always be people wanting to help the poor, struggling people of Afghanistan. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. But they don't come with a large paycheck. Doctors Without Borders does not dump money into the country.
You're right.
So it'll be interesting. So who in this negotiation, who do you see having the edge in the negotiation? The Taliban because of the United Front?
Absolutely.
Right. Jeff?
Yeah, I agree with Timmy plus Trump keeps yodeling about how he's going to get out of Afghanistan. So, puts the government at a – government's big ally is us, and he's like fucking fed up with them.
The one play that could work would be Abdullah heading the negotiating and actually making some concessions and acting and trying to get everybody to come along in order to eclipse Ashraf Ghani and basically follow it up with a coup. That would work. That would work out real well. But Abdullah is he's a Kabul dude. The guys down in the provinces, they don't respect people from Kabul. It doesn't matter that his mom was Pashtun and his dad was a Tajik. It doesn't matter. The only thing that matters is where the hell you grew up and what you did when you were growing up to those guys. And I don't see Abdullah having the chops to pull it off or the incentive. But that would be the only way this would turn out well.
Got it. All right. Now, we've had some technical difficulties, just so everybody knows. My compatriots here have been very gracious relative to. So, in the 10 minutes that we have left, let's talk about the United States unassing Germany too. I was a bit surprised. You've heard, I just saw Jim, Senator Inhofe say it'll take us years to formulate a policy and blah, 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 blah. And then lo and behold, old Jed's a millionaire, right? And I mean, that, I'll read you the headline. Plan to pull troops from Germany will take years, according to the top Republican from the Senate Armed Service Committee. And then today, if you read the article, right, this was part of the European Defense Initiative, and that is the racking and stacking of military units inside of Europe. And so all of a sudden we're leaving Germany. Thoughts, Will? Surprise?
Yeah. I mean, I read the thing, but it's I'm sure that there'll be a picture of some soldier getting on a plane tomorrow going home. But the way I read it, this thing rolls out over a couple of years. I mean, they're talking about moving brigades back to the U.S. And then headquarters units out of Stuttgart and send them to Mons, Belgium. I've never been to Mons. You know, you got to – I mean, something as simple as the freaking cube space and the zipper connections. You know, the Pentagon is right there in the middle of Washington, D.C. And it took, I don't know, 10 years to reconfigure that building. I was more interested in some of the language Esper used that was at least quoted in the article. He was very much, this is happening. It's a good thing. Here's the reasons that it's good. And it's funny because I saw people saying, well, there's a lot of people that are going to push back against it in Congress. And I'm thinking, who? Nobody represents Central Germany in the U.S. Congress.
Yeah.
I mean, if these guys are going to Fort Carson or Fort Hood, soon to be Fort whatever, or Fort Bragg, soon to
Fort
be
Sanford.
Yeah, those congressmen and senators are going to be saying, why aren't they here yet? But it's going to take it ain't going to be cheap. Some of it can get absorbed in other budgets, PCS and crap like that. But, you know, just the technical crap of moving hundreds of people into headquarters. So when I went to AWS, a guy in my conference group, 93, was the first Marine that went to Marfor-Ure in Stuttgart. Marfor-Ure had been in London before that.
Ooh.
And I think it took 6 or 8 or 9 months to transition, once they said go, people from London to Stuttgart. And if you look on a map, it's really not that far.
No.
But it just takes time. So I think the headline was a little more dramatic, perhaps, than the reality. But I think it's also, it might be part of the information campaign to keep bludgeoning people that this is happening and there are steps and we're going to do it. So,
right. You know, Will, you're right. Some of them are going to Mons. Some of them are going into northern Italy. And, like, I got the impression it was almost because Trump was pissed that they were paying only half of what they were supposed to pay.
Yeah.
Percentage-wise. And whereas Italy, though, is only paying that too. But you could say, well, Italy's on their ass more than Germany. And same thing with Belgium, you know. But
I'll tell you something. Everyone who's there is going to be pissed because they'd much rather be in Stuttgart than in Mons, Belgium. I'll tell you that.
Yeah. Mons was a very miserable World War I battle. I know that.
And southern Germany is a wonderful place to be.
Isn't that Bavaria?
Yeah, it's right down in there. It's a Catholic part of Germany. It's like every other Friday is some sort of Catholic holiday. They take the day off.
Wine fest.
Beautiful.
Beer fest.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was in Frankfurt. I was in Frankfurt for 17 months. I'll tell you what, I like Tehran a hell of a lot better than Frankfurt. That's just me.
You just have warm memories of Gunny, what's his face, kicking you in the balls when you said you were going to kick his ass.
Yes. I mean, that was the best thing that happened to me there, and it's better than everything that happened in Germany. No, not really. I'm being.
Hey, let me tell you, that is still one of the funniest stories I've ever heard on Allmarine Radio. And that is Jeff Kenny getting drunk and all hot and bothered telling his Gunny. Tell the story real quick. It's because it's great. I love it.
Drinking and I was we're drunk. I was drunk. And Gunny got sick of listening to me. And he goes, Corporal Kenny, I'm sick of listening to you. Go to bed. And I start to go because we always did exactly what this fucking guy said. And I was 19 years old, you know, and I go, wait a minute, guys.
Hold on. You have to give his name, Ronnie Lee Stepp.
Yeah, Ronnie Lee Stepp. Wait a minute, Gunny, aren't we on Liberty now? He goes, yeah. I go, well, then that means you can't tell me what to do. You know, the logic of a guy on gin and tonics. And he goes, oh, really? And he always wore a black sports coat, black slacks, cowboy boots, and like a pullover shirt with the collars out, like, you know, a la John Travolta of the time, you know. And so I go, I'll kick your fucking ass. And we end up outside. And so I start getting my fists up and shit. And he always he had a cigar in his mouth. He takes the cigar in his mouth. He kicks me in the ball. not that hard. And he goes, ooh. And then he grabs his shirt. And as I'm wiggling in it, he pushes me over these lawn chairs. And I'm on the ground. I'm throwing up. I don't remember this. I got told it later on with glee by my friend, Mike Maiman, who told me, oh, man, you made a jerk out of yourself. But Kenny goes, as I'm laying there throwing up, he says, hey, Corporal Kenny, I don't know if I can take any more of this ass with him. What do you say we call it a draw? So, that guy, though, I re-enlisted. I went to 1st Marine Division, and I went right – I called him. I said, hey, Gunny, I'm here. He said, I'll get you in 3-5 if you're crazy enough to want to do it. And he did. So,
one of the funniest stories I've ever heard. Hey, Corporal Kenny, I don't think I could stand any more of this ass whipping. How about we call it a draw? That is an awesome.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah. All right. The
hey, man.
Yes.
You know, regarding that move from Germany, I thought that we were talking about putting a lot of units up into Poland because the Poles were really keen about having us, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And none of them are going there. Now, back in the 90s, apparently, the Marine Corps made a very serious effort to abandon Okinawa. And they did a study, and they found that the best place to put a base where all those Marines in Okinawa would be Australia. And the Australians were more than happy to have us back then. And that got killed at General Kulak's level, who I think he was FMF PAC or something. But my dad said it was General Kulak was the first guy to go – oh, hell no. The wives will never tolerate this. We can't go to Australia. And that's where it ended, right then and there. Boom. That was a done deal.
That may be why
we're not going to Poland.
No, Poland. They're doing UDPs to Australia now.
Yeah, Poland. Yeah, no, now we do. But that, at that time, that was the end of the discussion. It was a dead topic.
I would say, though, to the idea of setting up a brigade-sized permanent facility or division size permanent facility in Poland, you know, Poland has probably come a long way, but it's still, you know, Eastern Europe. It's it's not Americanized.
Rough.
And the idea of taking people out of Germany, which is, you know, Germany has got all the upside of living in America, and it's still got the charm of Europe in it. It's different when you're sending people, you know, Poland's not the slums or anything, but it's different. And it's a long ways logistically to get it. So I think deployment for training type stuff, and that's why, you know, I think it's Romania, but we've been working in that Black Sea for a long time.
Right. It is Romania. The Special Forces MACTAF that goes to guys going into Romania and Georgia, as a matter of fact, you know,
lucky bastards.
Yeah. Well, we've been working there a long time, mm-hmm. and understand the facilities and lines of communication and support. and all of that stuff. I think Poland would be, not saying it couldn't be done, but then I think you're pushing the timeline back years to do that.
Interesting. The anything in that article and Esper was I was a little bit surprised how definitive he was about, you know, because you know you heard what you know what Inhofe said, and then all of a sudden, less than 48 hours later, the Secretary of Defense comes out and says, "Yeah," and so maybe there's truth in if Will's evaluation is right, Esper's action plan is going to be nested in Inhofe's timeline, and though it sounds aggressive, it won't be aggressive relative to the calendar, if that makes sense. Yay or nay?
I think you, in a very convoluted way, said what I said. Yes.
You know what?
Esper was pretty harsh about China last week too. He's been hitting. He's been out there, really giving some powerful speeches that are being completely ignored by the media. But he was definitely one out there calling bullshit on China also.
Well, the only thing that he did that broke squelch was when he, you know, the Confederate thing, because that gets at the president, which the media immediately jumped on and said, "Oh, Esper's, he's shedding his yes man image." So, I mean, the coverage of, you know, to me, our national media is disgraceful. I don't know anything that changes it, because it's a for-profit business, and it's not concerned at all about the truth anymore. I think it's pathetic, and I don't know what happens to a democracy when your media is so partisan and the truth doesn't matter.
Right.
Maybe that's the way it's always been, and I'm being Pollyanna here, but I mean, to me, it's ridiculous these days. I don't know.
You're absolutely right.
Don't get on that rush.
The one thing we got going for us, I never thought I would say this, is this social media and the technology, you know, that associate the internet. You got journalists everywhere.
Right.
Everywhere now. You know, anybody who sees something, you don't need to have them not report it when you got it on your iPhone and you're filming something that's happening. You send it to Joe Rogan or Mike McNamara or somebody.
Somebody.
And bang, there it is, you know?
Right.
People are going to hear about it.
All right. Well, you were going to make a point?
I just said we shouldn't get on the media riff. Be here for another 3 hours and
no shit.
14 technical interruptions.
Really?
We'd be like the frontline doctors talking about using hydrochloroquine for COVID. We'd be disappeared. I think that's what
we're
we'll
like.
Say.
We're like Radio Free Europe, or
broadcasting.
Or like in Red Dawn, the chair is against the wall. All right, we're being damned.
All right. Well, on that note, we will end this thing mercifully. Timmy, we need an update on how was school this week?
Well, school was kind of anticlimactic because half the students still don't have power or internet. I didn't get power for a couple of days, got internet yesterday. So today, as we were talking about the adolescent development of the brain, it was half the people weren't even there. So it was very strange because the instructor didn't seem to adopt to it well. Nice woman from China named Dr. Shen, and she just couldn't get over the fact that people hadn't figured out how to get on the Skype. Not one Skype call, whatever the hell we use to get that stuff. But class was class. I'm almost done. I got final exams in 2 weeks and then a week off, and then we start the real work next. We start global terrorism next on the fall semester. I can't wait.
Ooh.
Yeah, yeah. That sounds good.
Yeah.
All right. Any other? What are you reading? Right around the horn with what are you reading, and then we'll say goodbye. Will, what are you reading?
I'm still reading this book on the Holocaust, and the more I read, it's brutal. It's really brutal. He's got source documents, people that left journals, and we didn't even get to Auschwitz yet, and it's just brutal.
So you're doing the Einsatz group and in the firing squad.
Oh yeah. And so it just, and again, we all know the numbers, but this book, its names and its places and its people and its stories that he's quoting, and it's real inhumanity. And like I said, I thought I knew about it, but you just don't know. So I'll finish that this week, I think.
And tell everybody what's the name of it.
It's just called The Holocaust. It's written by Martin Gilbert, who I said was Churchill's official biographer.
Right.
So in between writing 11 volumes of Winston Churchill's biography, he found time to write 30 other books, I think, and one of them it was about the Holocaust.
Got it.
So,
Timmy, what are you reading?
Well, I listened to Rogan podcast 2 days ago, and he was mentioning this book, and he goes, "You've got to read it. It's terribly exciting. It's a real haunter. It's called Survivor Song by Paul Tremblay, and it was written before the COVID came, about a pandemic. This one was a variation of the rabies thing, and it's the worst goddamn book in the world." I'm reading this book and I'm like, first off, it's all involved in the lives of these two women that they're friends, and one of them's infected, and it goes on. And if you believe that all white guys have guns and are fat and incompetent, and that they're going to start shooting at the police during a pandemic because they believe that the UN's coming to take over with foreigners, if you believe any of that shit, then read the Survivor Song. It's written for you. But I was reading it, and I'm like, when does it get good? What the hell's wrong with Joe Rogan? I would have broken my Kindle if I didn't have so much self-control. I was so pissed I bought the thing. What a piece of shit book.
Yeah, don't just break off Kindle, man.
So
yeah, I'm not going to.
That's Tim Lynch on what he's not reading. Jeff, how about you? What are you reading?
Yeah, my buddy Kirkaby, I was telling you guys about, he sent me this book called The Real Lincoln by Thomas J. DiLorenzo. And it's like the realistic look at Lincoln through his speeches, you know, both prior to 1854, which was like a big change for him, and afterwards. And it's like it's surprising so far. I only read a couple pages.
What's surprising about it? And tell everybody the significance of 1854 for Lincoln.
Well, it's the thing that's surprising about it is not. It's not a hymn to Saint Abraham Lincoln. It's pretty, you know, it's got warts on him, you know. And 1854 is, I think, when he really became a national politician. And you know, he lost an election then, but he's on the national scene as much as, you know, the technology of the day would let somebody be on the national scene. And but he really was. It just shows about how the attitude was about, you know, the attitude up in the North towards black people wasn't really that much better than it was down South, you know, even up to the emancipation. So it's,
when you read Lincoln's speeches, the great emancipator, like, are you cherry picking his stuff? Like, what did that come up with? Right. I mean,
I know you're exactly right.
Great is a relative term in that sentence, in that paragraph. And, so it's interesting. All right. I would tell you is before you finish reading in your life, write down the name Taylor Branch. And he's written a trilogy about the civil rights movement, and John Lewis passed away. And regardless what you thought of John Lewis as a politician, if you want to talk about a courageous young guy when he was in college, John Lewis was instrumental in ending lunch counter segregation in Nashville, which is how he rose to national prominence in the civil rights movement. And he was one of the original freedom riders. And this trilogy, I mean, it reads like fiction, the shit that happened. In the South. I mean, you're reading it, and it reads like a novel, and it's just the craziest shit in the world. In the name of Jim Crow and segregation and whatnot. And so, when you read what John Lewis did as a young man, He was a divinity student, and he was going to school in Nashville, and you see him write, you know, I'm not sure if I'll live through this on a number of occasions. But he committed his life to it, and a long life of service to the country. He passed away. I bumped into him in the airport in Atlanta, and I was I was reading, you know, I think the second volume of that trilogy, and so I'm sitting in the airport, and I am sitting there reading, coming back from I think Quantico, and I look up and I'm like, holy shit, that's John Lewis. So I walk up and I introduce myself, and I had about a 15-minute conversation with him. And I told him, look, I said, I just want to come introduce myself and tell you how much I respect your courage and selflessness in terms of, you know, what you did during the civil rights movement. And I would tell you what's interesting about the trilogy is almost 3,000 pages, and so it's the competing the civil rights movement, like the Taliban. It wasn't one organization, right? It was all these different organizations. Some didn't like the nonviolent thing. Okay, that Dr. King espoused and was so prevalent. You know, some were tired of turning the other cheek. Some, were good at raising money. Others were not, right? Dr. King, what he would do was he would go give speeches. The money from the speeches would be used to bail out people in wherever they were, in jail, waiting to be bailed out. And, for instance, they were, having a huge march in Atlanta, and Dr. King's supposed to speak in Chicago and get paid like $80,000. Well, the $80,000 had to be used to get the people out of jail in Montgomery, but the people in Atlanta say, no, you've got to be here for this. And he says, I can't. And then they would badmouth it. Like, oh, yeah, Dr. King, he's too good for us and all that. And so you look at this and you'd like, Martin Luther King, man, he got cut no slack. Right. No, but it's this detailed look at all these different competing interests, right, at the national level, right, national level politics, the Democrats who the South is dominated by the Dixiecrats are huge in the Democratic Party. Civil rights can only lose you votes. Right. It can only lose you votes. So how do we craft this thing so we kind of look like we might be sympathetic to it without pissing off the Southern Democrats? And it really is. It's a fascinating study. I was reminded of it by John Lewis's death. And I would tell you, at some point in your life, and I would say listen to it because it's long. Throw it in your car, and when you drive long distances, listen to it because it's absolutely fascinating. So, with that said, Timmy,
I don't understand why all those guys were Democrats when Martin Luther King was Republican, and most black people before. Like the Second World War, we're fucking Republican. I don't understand how they managed to sell this bullshit that the Democratic Party is good for black people. Because it demonstrably is not and never was.
It's interesting when you talk to people that aren't very old and you tell them, like, yeah, the Democratic Party, that is the party of Jim Crow and the party of segregation. They're like, no, it's not. How could you say that? And then they come back like, yeah, you might want to look that shit up. And then they come back and they're like, I had no idea. I'm like, yeah. More of All Marine Radio coming up next right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.